Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to the Roots of Energy Efficiency. This is the third in the series of events on the history and future of energy efficiency in California. I'm Martin Giles, U.S. technology correspondent of The Economist, and I'll be moderating our panel discussion on the convergence of smart energy policy and technology. And I'm delighted to welcome my fellow panelists here. To my far right is John DeStasio, who's general manager and CEO of the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. To his immediate left is Cree Edwards, is Cree Edwards, who is founder and chairman of eMeter Corporation. To my left, immediate left, is Kristen Eberhardt, who's the legal director of Western Energy and Climate Products in NRDC's energy program. And to Kristen's left is Michael Peavy, who is president of the California Public Utilities Commission. As with previous panel, I'm going to ask each one of my panelists to make some opening comments, and then we'll go into a general discussion. John, would you like to kick off?
Good. Thank you, Martin. So it was interesting for me. I certainly don't profess to be a policy wonk, but when I was asked to do this, I have plenty of opinions about it, so I'd be happy to express those. Also, I will say one of the things when you consider smart grid as a new route for energy efficiency, I would just say at the outset, I do think that there's great promise for that to happen. That said, the policy aspects are not insignificant. I think Andrew in the last panel talked about the utilities orientation coming out of reliability orientation. We tend to make long-lived asset investments. We tend to be very focused on more of historically a command and control environment over the assets because of the reliability focus. So as we look to the future and look to a grid that creates a lot of transparency, a lot of interactivity, there is an interesting, as Nicole said, set of dancing partners when we start to see technology companies that, frankly, have been much more freewheeling because they're really, in a lot of cases, turning data into information. We're actually turning infrastructure into reliability. So there's a little bit of a collision course there. To that end, I will say we do see the smart grid having a lot of promise, and we do think it's going to be a technology platform that'll be a great integrator. But I also think when we look at policy, and I'll speak more to it later, policy needs to be done in that same integrated fashion. We can't just start unplugging data and moving it over here without understanding what that means to cyber, what it means to customer privacy, what it means to how utilities use energy efficiency as a resource in their supply portfolio. So I'll look forward to the discussion with my colleagues. Thank you.
Cree, thanks, John. Cree.
So I've been in the metering portion of the smart grid for about 20 years now. And in the last couple of years, people have actually been interested enough to talk to me at cocktail parties about that. And kids care. And one of the questions they ask is, will the smart meter save me money? And my answer is no, your smart meter will cost you money. It's the information generated from the smart meter that will save you money. In the integration of that information into business processes, both at the utility and in your daily lives. One of the big challenges that we're facing is not only as a country, but in the world, is that the IT infrastructures for electric utilities were built to handle monthly meter reads and customer calls. When you install a metering system, and this is something I think that's underappreciated today, the amount of data and transactions coming to the utility grows by 1,000-fold, and the infrastructure is not designed to support that. Now, as the information comes into the utility, unless it's actionable, it's not going to be of benefit to any of us. So it needs to be acted upon, and that gap's got to be filled. There are three areas the information has to be channeled to. The first one is into the smart grid. The meter is the foundation of the smart grid. It's the point of sale for the electric utility. And information from that about consumption is absolutely important to the smart grid, and that aggregation of that will show you what transformers and feeders and substations do. But it's also got quality of power information. The second is that without that automation, you can't do things in scale like distributed storage, distributed generation, net metering, managing electric vehicles on a large scale. The grid has got to have better control and understanding what's going on. And the third and most important from a policy standpoint is the information has got to be made available to the consumers. You don't buy any other service today when you don't get detailed accounting of how you spend your money, except in the electric, in the electric business. We've got to get you information by hour so that you can see what decisions you're making and what economic and carbon impact that decision has on your lifestyle. And if you make a behavioral change one day, you should see a confirmation the next day that that behavioral change actually did have an impact and needs to be converted into units of measurement that are comprehensible by you. So from a policy standpoint, what I'd like to drive here is the, and I know there's some cybersecurity issues and so forth. We've dealt with those in the finance industries, the telecom industries. We can deal with them here. But we've got to get information to the marketplace so we can create a private industry to support efficiency and automation of the of this industry.
Thank you. Kristen.
Thank you very much. One clap.
We'll do one round of applause at the end, ladies and gentlemen. Otherwise, we're going to be here clapping a lot. Kristen?
I think it's interesting that one of the most immediate global warming pollution benefits that utility sees from smart meters is has nothing to do with electricity grid. It's actually from reduced driving of the meter readers driving around to each house. But of course, most of, there are significant benefits that come from the electricity usage itself. And as we talked about, one of those is reduced peak. And I think it's important to note that reduced peak doesn't necessarily mean just peak shifting, which results in a net neutral in terms of energy use. The, our experience over decades of energy efficiency programs at utilities is that often peak reduction comes with total energy efficiency reduction. And then, of course, there's the exciting area of integration of renewables and electric vehicles, which is part of the important bridge to the 20th century of moving away from carbon-based energy. And then I think what we're going to focus on more today is how do you just improve energy, how do you use smart meters to improve energy efficiency and just reduce total kilowatt hours and start to bend that curve down, that California curve that's been flat for so many years. How do we really start to turn, do that right turn again? And I think that there's multiple ways that you can do that, both on the customer side and on the utility side. So from the customer's point of view, one of the things that helps them figure out how to reduce their total energy use is the information that they get, both the real-time information and what they see on their bill and what that tells them about what the next steps are that they should take. That information can be particularly powerful combined with a smart grid if it's targeted to the customer. So once you have information about what that customer's particular usage is, you can help them know what specific next step they should take. So for example, PG&E should probably tell Dan Riker to get a new toaster.
That's from our previous session where Google uses a lot of energy making toast. Well, one Googler.
And a lot of toast.
And then for customers bigger than Dan Riker, there's an opportunity to have continuous monitoring and optimization of equipment at commercial and industrial facilities. And then from the utility side, of course, they will be working with the customers on those issues, but there's also specific to the utility, having greater data from a smart grid can help them improve their evaluation, measurement, and verification. And this is something that has been is a constant point of uncertainty with utilities of how much energy are we really saving from these programs and can we bank on it and when is it coming and is it real? And so instead of resorting to some kind of, you know, well, we think it's going to be about this much and we hope that it was in fact that much and oh gosh, it actually wasn't that much and now we have to readjust the reward that we get and we have to readjust our programs. A smart grid can really hone in on what did that really look like for the utility. So I think that the touchstone with smart grid is what gets measured gets managed. And so in getting better data, more granular data, both to the utility and to the customer can help them manage and ultimately bring down their electricity use.
Great, thank you. Michael, from PUC's perspective.
Well, from the PUC's perspective, this we, the Public Utilities Commission, at least most of it, has been probably the biggest champion of smart meters and a smart grid, in the state of California. Actually, it goes back several years where I went to Italy and came back from Italy after having spent 2 days meeting with Enel, the Italian monopoly utility there, and they were putting in 30 million new meters. And I came back to California and said, why don't we do this? Why aren't we doing this? And it was being done by IBM, was a system integrator, and the Echelon, a San Jose company, was providing an essential piece of the puzzle here. And believe it or not, there was some resistance here in California by the utilities to wanting to move in this direction. There was a Southern California utility that said, we don't really need all this, and so on and so forth. PG&E was the most forthcoming early on, but then they started to put in meters that weren't the most technically advanced, let's just put it that way, and which we've had to go back and retrofit.
Andrew's left, I think.
but what really, to me, the policy is the technical issues, and I'll just make a brief mention of one of those, but the technical issues are not the challenge here. It's now getting this firmly in policy, and for me, it's all about the things that Kristen mentioned, plus it's truly smart meters and ultimately a smart grid will enhance the system, make it more efficient, reduce emissions, and for consumers, both industrial, commercial, and residential, it's all about empowerment, in my view. It's allowing people to have more say over how they use their electricity, when they use it, and how much they pay for it, and how that can affect their lives, whether it's charging their electric vehicles after 9 or 8 p.m., where they get a rate that's two or three times less than would be some other during midday, or and therefore using the surplus of wind power that we're soon going to have in California, or many other things. But that requires going to a time of use rates, and time of use rates is a function of the public utility. It's not PG&E doesn't get to decide whether you're going to have time of use rates or not. That's a decision. Some people are probably quite happy about that. But that would be a decision by the Public Utilities Commission, and then the mechanism would be PG&E or Edison or San Diego or so forth. What bothers me at the present time in the policy area is that there is, towards smart meters and ultimately probably smart grid, there is seems to be a significant, at least in Northern California, resistance, aided and abetted by consumer advocates who say that this is all a big waste of time and it's a ripoff and blah, 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 blah. And I flew up here from Los Angeles. Today's Los Angeles Times had a story on a postmortem on Proposition 16. Now, Proposition 16 was the measure that was defeated by 2-1 margin in the PG&E service territory and statewide, as we all know. One of the spokespersons against it is... one of the leading spokespersons against it is in the room, a former member of the Energy Commission. John Giesman should take some credit for this, baiting Peter Darby at the very start of the election. But anyway, my point is LA Times was that the reporter in this postmortem, Mark Lifcher, the LA Times, who should know better, writes a story and says that part of the problem for PG&E and the reason they fared so poorly, particularly in their own service territory, was their installation of smart meters, which increased their rates. I mean, and I almost felt like picking up the phone, and then I said, oh, try and talk to the press and some of these things is hopeless. But I mean, I'm sure any magazine with the name The Economist would be a bit above the curve on this, but I mean, it's just unbelievable. So now we've gone from smart meters as a localized problem in Kern County to the biggest newspaper in the state of California writing that smart meters are the cause of rate increases. And I thought a smart meter was an inanimate object. But I'm trying to be deferential to the study that we've undertaken at the Public Utilities Commission, which will be out in a couple of months, on the causes and effects of all this. But those kind of things, and now it's tied into EMF. Now there's a linkage to EMF. There's a community here in Northern California called Sebastopol, 7,000 people. They don't want Wi-Fi in downtown Sebastopol.
People have offered free Wi-Fi. They say, no, no, it creates EMF. Now they're onto smart meters, and they're convinced that smart meters cause EMF. And they told us at the PUC, we don't want any smart meters in Sebastopol. And there are several other communities in Northern California, some as far north as Humboldt and Mendocino counties, who may be motivated by the fact that smart meters will be able to give more evidence of consumption.
Somehow I think this here, is not going quite where I thought it was. but let's keep going, just briefly, for another minute or so.
We have serious challenges. I mean, these, and then the legislature and others picked this up. We have a special committee, the legislature, looking at all these things. And I mean, and honestly, the rollout has been poor. But give you just a taste. I mean, we've got over 2,000 complaints at the Public Utilities Commission about PG&E's installation of smart meters. Over 1,000 of them came out of the Sebastopol area in EMF. I mean, you can see, you push a button, you get letter writing and emails. But Edison, we've had 1 to 200. Now, PG&E's installed 5.7 million meters, so that's a lot of meters. And you look at 2,000 even, that's a pretty tiny number, but still, it's created a significant political threat. San Diego Gas Electric putting in meters, we have 2 complaints. So it's very interesting how these things go. My biggest concerns are, as we want to go to things like time of use rates and consumer empowerment, that some of these same kind of carryovers will negatively impact our ability to more rationalize this overall electric system and make it far better for everyone, every consumer, not just the companies, but every consumer. And I'm frustrated that some of the tone and all and the linkages here are spurious. Any case, that's my opening comment.
Thank you, Mike. If I may sum up what you just said, the press sucks, but actually we're doing some pretty good job here in getting meters in and making sure that people understand, or we're trying to make sure that people understand what to do with this information. And you know, the good points, I mean, I think, you know, the California has led the way here. Two questions, really, I think, for all of you, anyone can open to take it. First question is, how much more direction should there be in terms of information sharing, and what happens with the information that comes from these meters? What should consumers be given, at what level of detail, and how is that a role of government or a role of policymakers, and how much of that is a role of the market and PG&E and others who may decide what they want to share? Who would like to take that question first? Cree, go ahead.
Yeah, we work with utilities all around the world, and up in Ontario is an interesting example of utilities rolled out all of their meters. Every customer has access to their hourly data, and they own that data. They can share it with whomever they'd like to share it with. Every customer is on a variable price rate, and they get almost no complaints. So my view on that is that the information should be owned and controlled, the direction of the information will be owned and controlled by the customer. If the customer wants Google to have it, for whatever Google can help them do it with, they should empower Google to have it. And the entire, I mean, any marketplace is based on a free or easy exchange of information and transparency. And the customer should be, as they are with their bank statements and their cellular phone bills and so forth, they should be in control of their energy usage profiles.
Right. John, you're nodding. Yeah.
I mean, I actually agree with that. I think the customer should have the data. We're thankfully only about 70,000 meters into our smart meter rollout, and we took a little different tack because from my perspective, one of the things that, and I think it was said earlier, the consumer education has really been lacking, so that when people get a smart meter, and every other piece of technology you get, you see immediate benefit. And you get a smart meter, and as my mother said, what's so smart about this thing? It's on my house, it looks just like my other meter. So it's getting the technology in a good way, and then I think it'll be an enabler to get these things done. Once said, I think the consumer should have all of the data, but I think just to have the data go to consumers without also understanding when they get it and it goes to third parties, and a third party gets it,
absolutely,
and now they aggregate maybe energy efficiency from those consumers and it goes to a wholesale market instead of the utility, and the utility's underlying rates are recovering a lot of fixed costs in the energy, all of a sudden there's a conflict. When I look at transformation and transition, I always look at what are the barriers and what are the the conflicts of getting there. So I agree wholeheartedly with what Cree's saying, and frankly, even with what Dan's saying. But right now, the way that, especially investor-owned utilities, the incentives they get, even decoupling, won't be adequate to deal with this problem. So we do need to figure out how to change our underlying rate structures, how we recover fixed costs out of our energy sales. And then also, I think we need to make sure that that the utilities have a path forward to be able to make this in some sort of a, this transition in some sort of a rational way, so they're not, frankly, having some customers' energy leaving, and frankly, the balance of the customers be left with higher bills and increasing rates because they're picking up a bigger share of the fixed cost.
Right. And just so I understand, in terms of third parties having access to data, I mean, one of the things that really could drive energy efficiency is if you have a lot of competition between people who are taking that data and representing it to the customer and saying, look, you know, we're all competing with each other to get the best possible information in your hands, the most actionable. But there's presumably a trade-off. You've got to draw the line somewhere. I mean, how should government do that, or is that something for the market to
decide? I think that certainly because we're regulated, whether we're locally smudged, locally regulated and governed by an elected board and the investor-owned utilities, frankly, I think that the utility commissions have to play a role in that and the governing bodies have to play a role in that. Well, frankly, I don't know that it would happen.
I mean,
it's only that push to make it happen that's going to have that happen.
So how open should it be?
I actually just wanted to take a step back, from the actual data, but before the smart meters are installed, I think there's an important role for a regulatory or policymaking body, whoever the relevant one is, to say, do you have a plan for communicating with your customer about what this is going to do for them, and then for following up on that. So as Cree said, if somebody says, is this going to save me money? And the answer is no. I think that's an important thing for our customers to understand, that they are used to getting technology and having it be magical. You know, my iPhone is magical, and it does cool things, and I don't have to really understand that much about it in order to, touch it. But customers need to understand up front, and I think this is something that regulators can make sure that there's a plan for making sure customers understand. The box is not going to do magical things for you. The box is going to enable you to then take action, where then you are going to make magical things happen. But you have a role in that. And so making sure that they know that they have a role, and then following up with them with the targeted information of, it looks like you have 4 washing machines in your basement that you're
But how nanny-ish do you get? I mean, the nanny state says, turn off your washing machines here. Here's the information I've given you. You mustn't do this. I mean, that's not very American in my experience. God bless this wonderful country. Michael, I know that you might have a different view,
No, my view is pretty much what Cree said. I mean, if this is all about what I said earlier, customer empowerment, then you want the customer to have as much freedom as is humanly possible here to make decisions with the most credible real-time information, all kinds of ways. No, we don't want to say you cannot charge your electric vehicle at noon at your house if you wish to, but we're saying that since the system costs may be higher at noon or 4 p.m. than it is at 9 p.m., that if you wish to do that, the price would be higher. People have done this on cell phones and got quite adept at it. To John's point, though, for the utility, what we've tried to do, if you see the meters as just only a step in customer empowerment, and you see meters, and that's all they should be seen as an enabler that leads to time of use rates and various other things that may reduce usage, certainly will alter usage patterns, which is a plus, which makes the system overall more reliable, reduces greenhouse gases and so forth. But also, for the utility to want to do this enthusiastically, we have, at the PUC, John said, decoupling's not enough. Decoupling is breaking the nexus between earnings and revenues. We did that in California 25 years ago. The next step is to reward utilities for energy efficiency programs, allowing them to have a return on investments in energy efficiency so that they become neutral as to whether they build a new power plant or they spend the same amount of money on something else. And we've started down that road in California. We stumbled the first go-around in terms of getting all the incentives right, and we're still litigating aspects of it. But the concept is right. And we'll perfect that with the help of a lot of people, and that's the right way to go. So that everything is together, that's in sync. The incentives are right, reduction is right, usage is right, consumer is empowered, and a consumer could reject the time of use rates. They don't have to have it, or they could consume at their during the peak period as much as they possibly want, if that is their choice. The tests we've had, pilot projects we've shown, even in Kern County, working with PG&E, is that low-income people are more price-responsive than wealthy people, actually, to price, which is something that the nanny state doesn't necessarily accept and wants to order certain behavior. You don't have to order certain behavior. You just give people the right information and incentives. Usually people respond properly.
Right. And Chris, does that answer your concerns about the upfront here in California anyway? Okay. There was a question from the floor about gas and the importance of the meter for, because their meter also monitors gas usage. And how do we all think that gas is going to be as affected by this as electricity? Cree, you're shaking your head.
Let's be frank. We're putting in all new gas meters, too.
Yeah.
We're putting in all new gas meters. PG&E is Southern California Gas Company, which is solely a gas, not a gas and electric company. The case, the economic case, the environmental case for them is pretty marginal. As a regulator, I say, I haven't approved $1 billion expenditure. To say that it's pretty marginal is not probably what the most reassuring thing that people want to hear.
I'm glad we're talking about technology and regulation.
But it's based on a belief that, yes, you could justify it economically, gas meters, even though gas doesn't have it's not like electricity and so forth. It can be stored and what have you. But over time, we'll get more and more sophisticated about use of gas and the value of gas meters, and I think it'll turn out to be a winner. Right now,
it's not a loser, but it's
kind of marginal, to be frank.
The short-term benefits for gas is the elimination of a meter reader. It's an operational benefit. It's an O&M. It doesn't, because it is storable, you don't have to worry about a lot of the peaking issues you have with electricity.
Right.
So the value of time-based information on gas is far less important. Now, there are gas losses, there are gas issues that can be dealt with over time through smart grid with gas, but you don't get the short-term peaking benefits,
okay.
I don't think.
I was just going to say that a lot of the benefits and a lot of the drivers for the utilities initially to do this, whether it was electric or gas, was the O&M savings by not having manual meter reading. Gas gets that, electric gets that. But then as you start to move down the value chain on energy efficiency or demand response, peak reduction, it starts to fall apart on the gas side. The one thing that doesn't get talked about enough in smart meters, and in fact I'm very excited about it, is we don't have as much transparency and control within our own distribution grid as people think. So there's actually a lot of energy efficiency that will be mined on the utility side of the meter that isn't even getting talked about. In our system, we think we can get 2% on 11,000 gigawatt utility. That's a power plant just from having more efficient control of our own assets.
Right. There was a discussion in the previous panel briefly about a letter that Google was among the signatories of this letter to the federal government, calling on the federal government to act and mandate certain minimum standards for smart meters and sharing of information, openness, etc. Is this something that federal regulators, policymakers should be getting involved in, or is really something that should be dealt with at the state level?
I think it should be dealt with the state level, and in our case, the local level. I think they should the feds have a role in setting. I think one of the things that would benefit a lot of this is getting national climate legislation done and the right incentives in terms of a carbon price to move the country more towards doing these things. But historically, the states and in the muni world are better suited to regulate these things based on what's going on in their own communities and regions and states.
I think there is a federal role for standardization and interoperability. So within SMUD's territory, you know, they have a lot of opportunity to interact with their customers to improve the performance of their distribution system. They should have you know, some freedom to do that. But they're nonetheless connected to the whole Western grid. And making sure that there is interoperability between all of the actors on that grid is critical, and that's best played by the federal government.
And I agree wholeheartedly on interoperability and standards of those types. What I was speaking to was Dan's comments around the freedom of information aspect, which I do think that may have different implications in different places, and I do think the states are well suited to regulate that.
Well, I strongly support federal standards for energy efficiency and for renewables. And part of it, and you can't have the kind of goals we want for energy efficiency without having a smart grid, and we can't have a smart grid without smart meters. So there's a logic, I think, the train that is somewhat irrefutable. So I'd love to have it with California, you know, the kind of same exception we have under the Clean Air Act and all. If we want to set standards above a federal standard, that's fine. We could do that, but that there ought to be minimum federal standards in this area, and the president has called for it. I mean, he's articulated the need for a smart grid and so forth.
The president's called for it. If the president, for whatever reason, can't get it through, can California still make the right turn, the downward move in per capita consumption that Alan talked about at the beginning, without that federal overlay?
I mean, yes.
Can this state
yes.
do it by itself?
Yes. It's very difficult, though, it's my goal, my personal goal, to see policies in place that reduce per capita electricity use in California. And I'd like to see gas use, too, be reduced on a per capita basis. But how that's to be achieved is very difficult, particularly if you're going to go to millions of electric vehicles. It runs counter to that very thing.
Right.
But we certainly can make the overall system far more rational and effective through time of use rates and various other things.
Okay.
And John's absolutely right, incidentally. Until smart meters came along, the fact is that most electric systems, if you had an outage at your house alone, the utility didn't know you were off the system. Believe it or not, that's the way it was. They don't know that you have no power at your house. Now, if it happened in your neighborhood, that it lights up. But it's your home. This is going to change all that. So these alone are efficiency improvements that don't get recognized, that are very, very positive ones.
Got it. And John, for Sacramento, how far could you push by yourselves in terms of driving customer behavior? I mean, you have a lot of freedom of movement.
Yeah. Well, much like even PG&E, we've been at energy efficiency and some of these things for 30 years, dealing with standards. I look at the smart grid as the next step, because just creating the transparency and then with the technology's control and putting in the consumer side, I believe that if you're consumer-centric in the policy making, and just as President Peavy said, I think that people will act out of their own best interest, armed with the information and the control. And I don't think it needs to be a nanny state. I actually think that'll happen, and I think a lot of it will be able to happen in Sacramento. The interesting dilemma, I think, and the next panel is going to talk about behavioral, there's not a lot that we know. We've done some pricing
right.
studies, but getting the pricing right and doing what they've done with cell phones, where we understand congestion pricing, especially if you have teenagers, the reality is getting people to have that same thought pattern about energy on the nights and weekends. The big policy question there is it going to be mandatory? Is it opt-in, opt-out?
Right.
And how do consumers respond to that? I think that's going to be a big issue.
Okay.
Yeah, we're all already on to the rate issues. I think that I'm a firm believer that if people should pay for what they consume.
Yes.
We shouldn't dummy it down for them. If they want to consume energy when it's really expensive, fantastic.
That's right.
And unless we can figure out how to get the pricing signals to them so they can make those decisions,
absolutely.
The marketplace will work. People will respond.
Yes.
I mean,
It's a good point. And just following following up on that, it's getting the price signals to them. There's a question from Jonathan Livingston, who asks, you know, what would it take to create a smart grid ecosystem where sort of Apple, and we had Apple iWatch before, now we're having Apple Smart Grid, where developers are vying to build and launch cool new efficiency apps? so that you could run them on your iPhone, you run them on droids, et cetera. Does that happen? I mean, how much should government be opening up the information to everybody to create an app ecosystem around energy efficiency? Any views?
Great.
Well, yeah, the support of the app environment needs to be supported by the utility itself. There's got to be a platform that they build off of that will allow the transportation of information across all the different mediums. There should be text messages to people when their power goes out. There should be lots of products and services there. Now, what will happen here is when the thing opens up and the meters are deployed and the information is available, is you should make anybody be able to write an application that they can have access to the data. The tricky thing will be making sure that they're authorized to get that data, and that's what people are going to have to work with. But I think you're going to see the same type of really interesting developments here that you have seen in some of the other industries around energy.
Yeah.
Okay. A key to creating a successful ecosystem like that is making sure that the policies are in place so that the utilities are motivated to pursue that type of ecosystem. So as President Peavy said, if we have decoupling, which makes the field neutral, and then if we have a successful risk-reward mechanism in place, then the utilities are motivated to make sure that they're getting the highest performance they can from their customers out of those smart grids. And so then they'll look around for who can provide them the best service in terms of communicating with their customers and really pinpointing what their customers want. And, you know, every customer is going to be different. So just giving them the information isn't necessarily going to motivate every single customer in the same way. I think a case study in this is the Prius, which gives you real-time information about your energy use. You know, there's a little display. Yeah. I'm sure many people in the audience have driven a Prius or know somebody who does. And so when you see that little display, you know, some people react to that little display and go, oh, cool, you know, a leaf. And then some people look at that display and become hypermilers. I don't know if you've met one of these people.
The other one's going incredibly slow in the outside lane. I've met them.
So some of your customers will be hypermilers, and some of them will be like, oh, Elite is cool. And so finding the right app or the right third-party provider to really talk to those customers in their language will be important.
And another question from the floor, saying monthly residential utility bills, you know, for many residences, they're in the range of $100 to $200. And you see the information coming in and you think to yourself, well, just how much benefit really is it going to be to me? It's an effort to take this information, process it for a few bucks off my bill. Oh, I can't be bothered. So actually, the energy efficiency gains from smart meter for a lot of people out there really aren't going to be very big. And therefore, is there something that the government, again, or regulators should be doing to somehow market that saving harder?
I don't think so. I actually think, and Cree kind of hit on it, I think once the technology platform gets in there, once we figure out the right policy answers to the data issues, data privacy and so forth, I actually think innovation will come because the platform will enable it. Right now, it's you know, when you had an iPhone, without the apps, it's not as interesting, but all of a sudden, when you get the apps, that's where the innovation comes from. And to me, once we can figure out how to crack the nut where people can get even a small amount of savings with little effort on their part, where they can program something or they can optimize when you start having smart appliances, if somebody can say, hey, I don't want my bill to be over $150, what do I have to optimize in my energy profile to get there? Then I think people will do it even if it's relatively modest savings.
Right. And in terms of the kind of price signals that one sends out and the options that consumers get in terms of pricing over their energy consumption, I mean, how much breakdown should you have? I mean, is there not a risk of paradox of choice where you give them so much choice that all of a sudden it becomes so complex? I mean, you mentioned cell phones. I look at my cell phone bill and I despair. Maybe it's because I work in the media and I'm not quite up to speed on it, but it really is something that you can give people too much information. How do you draw the line, Michael?
Well, I do agree that there. Well, I think that it's largely true that if you look at your utility bill, they're today they're largely unintelligible. I mean, I can't speak. Well, I see smud bills too, but and smud, I might add, just as a, you wouldn't expect me necessarily to say.
You don't
this,
have to be nice.
They have no, but they have been a real leader in a whole bunch of innovative areas in the state for quite a few years, including energy efficiency and all. And they just won a big contract from us in our solar research program. They got number one, and somebody said to me, "Well, how can you give the smud? You don't even regulate them." I said, "You know what? They got the best. They came up with the best." Best proposal. But the utility bills are complicated, and I get an Edison bill, I get a PG&E bill, and my wife gets a SMUD bill, so I see them all. And none of them are easy to understand, very frankly, and there's a lot of terminology and all that stuff there. They could be greatly simplified, but they all have one common characteristic, and that is they have tiers. And so it's not, you get your total bill, and it may be $200, but if you could shave the fifth tier down significantly, the savings are considerable.
Right.
Now, I'll just give you the anecdotal evidence of that. We have, in my house in La Cañada in Southern California, my wife drives a BMW all-electric car. BMW have made 500 of these electric cars, brought them to the United States. 250 are in New York, 250 in Southern California. She's in the California legislature. She was able to, whatever means, got the electric car.
You just spend millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars, right?
It's a great little car. It's the Mini, and it goes like hell. It's very fast, and the only limit is it gets maybe 75 to 80 miles range. Edison has a peak and has a rate, on and off peak rate. They had to come out and put a time of use meter on our house for that. They have an on and off peak rate. In the summertime, I think it's 6 cents off peak. That's 9 p.m. and later, and Saturday and Sundays. And on peak is like 17 cents. That's kind of like the first tier. She's become passionate about never plugging it in until 9 o'clock. And the next evolution is to have a timer on the charger so that you can't start until 9 o'clock. But she doesn't plug it in. And then she asks me each month, how much do we save on this? And we've had the car for a year now.
Right.
So, I mean,
can
the
you do
point is
else?
The behavior changes, and people respond to prices.
Right.
Just like, she also clips coupons.
Right.
So maybe she may be,
so
and
how
goes
much,
to Ralph's, you know, with the 5 cents off. Mike, the vodka, you get another bottle of vodka for a dollar less. Shall I get it? I say, I don't like Smirnoff. But anyway.
So now we have drink driving, which I'm really happy about, from the Public Utilities Commissioner. I would like to just ask you, how much should you be doing, though? Shouldn't you said, you know, this is really important. I recognize tiering. I recognize this drives behavior. So we want to get this downward right, this right turn in per capita consumption. Could you be more dictatorial? Not that it's in your nature, but could you be more dictatorial in putting down the kinds of things that actually utilities should put in their bills?
Well,
we're
the ones that set the rates.
You set the rates, but could you be more dictatorial about then, you know, driving them down even more, give more detail, give more options, give more.
Yes,
there'll be complaints left, right, and center.
Yeah, it becomes a difficult in some cases question because, believe me, the first thing you hear from one major utility is, oh my God, our IT department will have to spend another $200 million to do this, and is it cost effective, and all this stuff. And then you know, and the CEO says, oh, that's a great idea, we're going to do it, and then you get. No, we can't do it. I mean, we have those kind of challenges on an ongoing basis, very frankly.
Yes.
And it's not all that clear. I mean, there's definite improvements that can be made in bills. You can show stuff graphically and so forth that the companies ought to do in self-interest, in my view.
Yes,
you should make it in your own self-interest, have your people understand better what your customers but what they're being charged.
But of course, we all know.
I think this really goes back to the ecosystem development. And if you get the policies right, you know, so if the utilities are motivated, if the rates are set such that the utilities are motivated to shave their peak, to reduce their load, then they'll go out and figure out how to do that. And there are third parties out there who know how to do this, who know how to simplify this information, and who are expert at conveying complicated information in a way that is going to help people understand and take action on that information. You know, once the motivation is there,
yes,
I think people will figure out how to do it.
Yeah, I'm a big choice guy. I think if you make as much information available as you can, and if they don't want to see it all, they're going to pick a rate that's simple. and people will choose what they want, and you go from there. But the marketplace will take care of that.
John?
I think it's also important, to, as we talk about, everybody's talking about consumer education is the most important piece. Your bill is the one thing everybody gets every month. So that is actually an opportunity to communicate what are your underlying costs and when is it more expensive. And frankly, as all utilities, we don't do a very good job of that. We just really do a job of putting the billing out there to make sure we're collecting the revenue. So we can use it much better as a tool to educate people.
Okay. I have a question from the floor. It says anonymous, but I suspect it's from Jerry Brown. It says, can we make that right turn in energy efficiency if Meg Whitman wins and suspends AB3? Jerry, where are you? Okay, can we make that right turn if Meg Whitman wins and suspends AB3? Who wants to take that one?
No.
No, that's easy. Why not?
Well, if she,
there's nothing else we can do.
If she's true to her promises.
Right.
Which are often get adulterated as time goes on in the rigors of a political campaign.
Yeah.
So I don't take anything too seriously on that. I mean, the bigger question is, everybody in this room do everything they possibly can to defeat the effort led by the Adam Smith Foundation, Tesoro, and Valero, as out-of-state oil companies, to suspend AB 32. The most critical thing probably coming out of any group of people today is to do everything they can to not only defeat that effort, which will be on the ballot this November, but to defeat it so resoundingly efforts like that don't come back, and it encourages more green efforts rather than less.
I expect to see a softening in Meg Whitman's position now that she's won the Republican primary and it needs to now win a statewide election in a state that overwhelmingly supports moving towards a clean energy future. So she, as President Peavy said, is not the biggest threat. But the ballot initiative that is likely to qualify for the ballot in November would indefinitely suspend AB 32.
It did qualify.
It has qualified. And all of the policies under it. And that is a huge threat to everything that we're trying to do here. So I agree. That is the number one priority, is to keep that from passing.
Okay. And talking of oil companies, I have a question from Russ Yarrow of Chevron. It comes back to driving again. He says, I drove over the San Mateo Bridge today, 7-mile stretch of freeway, with cruise control at 65 miles per hour. I counted 52 cars that passed me. Cars going 75 miles per hour use much more fuel than cars going 65. At various points over the past decade, consumers have been given price and policy signals about the wisdom of conserving fuel. But even with these meters in their cars, they don't do it. So how can government, you know, what are we missing here? What's wrong? We're giving people information in their cars, for heaven's sake. You know, Nissan has these, you know, consumption meters in every car, and yet there's still people passing Russ, who's actually one of those hypermilers, actually. I don't think he was doing 65. But anyway, so what can we do? I mean, people just don't respond, do they? Back to the nanny state.
Well, not everybody has a meter in their car.
Not everybody has a meter in their car. But even if they did, you know, will we see behaviors change? And if so, should government be doing even more to pressure that change?
And I think this goes back to figuring out what people respond to, right? So not everybody responds solely to the information.
Right.
Not everybody, you know, sometimes going 75 is more important than whatever marginal gas you might save. So I think that figuring out who responds to what and really getting at that. So sometimes people, the hypermilers, will respond to the simple information. Other people will respond more strongly to what their neighbor is doing. That they don't, you know, their meter, yeah, you know, Leafs, whatever. But if they look over and see that the car next to them is doing something cooler than them, well, boy, now they're gonna, that'll change their behavior. But I think, you know, getting at what really motivates people is an important thing to do with this data.
But just one quick comment on this. But in that example, people are trading time. They think they're going to get there faster.
Right.
And time is a precious commodity for almost all of us. And the older you get, the more precious it is. But we're not talking about that so much in energy efficiency. I mean, you're talking about putting the dryer on at 9 p.m. instead of 4 p.m. talking about putting your pool sweep on so it starts at midnight. You do that once. This is not again and again and again and again kind of adjustment. So some of these lifestyle adjustments are easy to make, and some are difficult to make. And some of those easy to make ones, when prompted by price signals, mm-hmm. I think, you don't have to have a nanny state telling you have to do every little detail under the sun to have those outcomes.
Right.
I think also, I bet those 75 cars that passed him are more fuel efficient than they were 10
right.
years ago.
Right.
And so there's a lifestyle decision. Do I want to drive fast? Do I want to drive slowly? And how much money am I willing to pay to drive fast? And the same thing, the benefits and energy will be the same. The long-term versus short-term investment into energy efficiency will...
The analogy might be, what kind of car did that person buy that they're driving right. 75 miles an hour, which is similar to what kind of refrigerator did
right.
you buy,
exactly.
which is inevitably better today than it was 30 years ago.
Great. We're getting close to finishing, so I just wanted to ask each one of you, if you would, just to perhaps make a few closing comments, maybe a minute each, just to sort of summarize your views, whether anything in the conversation has particularly stood out to you. I started with John, so perhaps this time around we'll go from Michael.
Well, I would just say that in terms of meters and grid and all that, that California, I think, is very much on the right track. I mean, that's self-serving, obviously, but it's not my role alone. It's also the California Air Resources Board, California Energy Commission, the efforts of utilities, the efforts of municipal utilities like Los Angeles and SMUD and others. And I think, by and large, was a little bit of pushing and shoving and kicking every now and then, that the policy direction is the right one. The big challenge that we already referenced was, I think, this effort on AB 32, which I think will be rebuffed, but I'd like to see it rebuffed very, very significantly. And as long as we can continue that policy direction, it's our job to help others understand the value of this in other states. And that's why I support a national efforts, not minimum, at least very at the least, some sort of minimum standards on energy efficiency, on renewables, and so forth, so that we can the country can move in the right direction. I think that's hopefully that will happen this year. We'll see if the things like BP and all that have stimulated that. We have a tremendous amount of work to do in this state. Even with the accomplishments we've made in holding per capita usage of electricity, as an example, pretty much constant for 30 years, there's still a lot of low-hanging fruit. There's still a lot more we can do. We're not as energy efficient as France. We're not as energy efficient as Japan. And there are different reasons for that. Japan, its prices, they're very, very high. By California standards, prices are extremely high. France, it's because they have their land use is done in a different manner, and because they have heavily invested in nuclear energy, and so on and so forth. We have much more to do in this state. Where I think we're on the right track. I hope we continue to have the public support for the policies that are evidenced by the governor, this administration, the previous administration, and hopefully the next administration.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, as President Peavy said, I think we're on the right track here in terms of the policies in California. For the investor-owned utilities, we have decoupling. We have a risk-reward incentive mechanism. We're still honing it, but we're in the right direction. And from the sort of bigger perspective, we have AB 32, which is encouraging the entire state to become cleaner, more efficient, and move away from fossil fuels. So continuing all of those policies, I think that's really the framework that creates the motivation for utilities and consumers and others to use this information to move in the same direction that those policies are all pointing towards, a cleaner, less fossil fuel dependent future.
Thank you. Cree?
I agree with President Peavy also that the challenge we have in the marketplace today, and I think President Peavy's done a phenomenal job driving this marketplace. There's no pull from utilities for this technology. It's incredibly politically difficult. At some point, we have to align the interests of the utility shareholders with the ratepayers or the customers and the environment. Electric utilities will make less money if they become significantly more efficient. They don't need to build power plants. They should make more money by promoting efficiency, by promoting conservation. They should be rewarded for that. And if we don't find a way from a public policy standpoint to do that, it's going to be a painful step after painful step after painful step with litigation and everything else, and it's going to take us forever to get there. So my hope is, I have no suggestions on how to do this, by the way, but, that smart people can figure out how to make sure that the largest stakeholder here, which is our utility, can benefit from this transition.
Yeah, so coupling, decoupling.
Coupling's a step in the right direction, but the long-term payback is still based on assets.
Right. Thank you. John?
And, you know, interesting. That's why SMUD gets credited as being a leader, but our incentives aren't misaligned because we're consumer-owned, and so we're really cost-based. We're spending our consumers' money for their best interest. So that makes it a little bit easier path for us. We're not conflicted. That said, I think whatever policies we have, they have to be consumer-centric. I do think that we need to look at understanding the barriers, whether they be financial for utilities and so forth. Also, we need to understand the competing priorities. If we're dealing with greenhouse gas reduction and we're looking at electrifying transportation, that has an impact on the emissions in the utility sector. So we need to figure out how to make sure we get those policies right. And then finally, I think we absolutely do need to get the incentives right, whether it's for consumers or for the stakeholders in the process.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all my panelists. We're going to break for just a few minutes now, but I just want to have one last comment. I wanted to thank President Peavy for pointing out that the press doesn't always get things right, which is very true. But one thing that we have written at The Economist, we've written a number of pieces about green, about the smart grid and the greening of California. We called it Wiser Wires. And I think, you know, what you've heard in the first session and in this session is that we really have in California taken some great steps forward towards wiser wires. There's more to do. The Economist has some views as to what government should do and what government shouldn't do, what utilities should do and what the market should do. We put them very forcefully, but I've been delighted to be invited to chair these two panels. I think they've been terrific, and I please thank all of my panelists on this session today.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.